Good morning, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster Cicely Tiernan with today's Wall Street Journal. America's U.S. plays down quick return to democracy in Venezuela. Many Venezuelans welcome the ouster of Maduro, but worry his repressive regime remains in place, by David Luthnow and Jose de Cordoba. President Trump ticked off a list of reasons for his decision to capture and arrest Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. He talked about the Maduro regime sending illicit drugs and gangs to the U.S. and nationalizing American oil company assets. One thing that wasn't mentioned, a desire to restore democracy in Venezuela. Instead, Trump said the U.S. would run the country indefinitely until a safe, proper, and judicious transition could be arranged. He didn't raise the prospect of elections. The president said it would be tough for the country's opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, who recently won the Nobel Peace Prize, to play a major role, saying she lacked popularity. Instead, he expressed a willingness to work with Delcy Rodriguez, Maduro's vice president, a hardline socialist and regime stalwart. On Sunday, Secretary of State Marco Rubio played down expectations of a quick return to democracy, saying it was unrealistic. They've had the system of chavismo in place for 15 or 16 years, and everyone's asking why 24 hours after Nicolas Maduro was arrested, there isn't an election scheduled for tomorrow. That's absurd, he said on CBS's Face the Nation. Chavismo, the political movement founded by the late Hugo Chavez, has actually run Venezuela now for 27 years. Rubio outlined the more immediate goals for the U.S. in dealing with the Venezuelan regime under Rodriguez, who is now the interim president, and said Washington would use an effective blockade on Venezuelan oil exports, as well as the threat of further military force as leverage to force the government to change its behavior. We want drug trafficking to stop. We want no more gang members to come our way. We don't want to see the Iranian and, by the way, Cuban presence in the past. We want the oil industry in that country not to go to the benefit of pirates and adversaries of the United States, but for the benefit of the people. We want to see all of that happen, he said. For many Venezuelans, including millions of those who have fled the country to places like the U.S., the initial glee of hearing Maduro's capture has given way to growing angst that while Maduro is gone, the rest of his regime remains intact and appears set to stay in power for the foreseeable future. Venezuelans are alternating between euphoria that Maduro is out, but disappointment that the guys with guns and the structure of guns and corruption is still running the show, said Moises Naim, a former Venezuelan trade minister and analyst at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Even if the regime softens and changes policy to please the Trump administration, that feels more like colonial submission and doesn't give ordinary Venezuelans a say in their future, said Rafael Benanga, a community activist in Caracas. This isn't what we expected in any way, and it seems to frustrate our expectations. I can't see most people supporting this, he said. Larry Gumbiner, a former senior U.S. diplomat who served in half a dozen Latin American countries during a 31-year career, said the Trump administration is clearly giving priority to stability over democracy. Trump's plan, Gumbiner said, appears to be to keep the Maduro government in power minus Maduro, with the condition that the new president carries out Trump's programs of allowing U.S. oil companies to rebuild the oil sector, stopping drug trafficking, and stopping support for Colombian guerrillas active in Venezuelan territory. If not, the presence of the U.S. fleet keeps alive the threat of a second round of attacks and captures. There are good reasons why the Trump administration might not be able to impose a fast transition to democracy. Venezuela's army and other security forces remain loyal to the regime and have benefited from widespread corruption under Maduro and his predecessor Chavez. Absent a much larger U.S. military operation, they might be unwilling to cooperate. The interim president, Rodriguez, will also have to keep the support of Defense Minister Vladimir Padrino and Interior Minister Diosdado Cabello, hardliners who face U.S. criminal charges similar to those of Maduro and may balk at seeking an accommodation with Washington. So far, Rodriguez's government has struck a defiant tone, telling its people it will oppose what it describes as Washington's imperialist ambition to undermine Venezuelan sovereignty and take its oil. Venezuela's constitution says that Rodriguez, who was sworn in as acting president Saturday, must call for a new presidential election in 30 days if the president's absence is permanent. But Venezuela's Supreme Court, stacked with regime supporters, has ruled that given the extraordinary circumstances of Maduro's absence, it needs to study the question. That puts, at the moment, no time frame for Rodriguez's rule. Some in Venezuela's opposition reacted angrily after Trump's comments failed to mention holding new elections or forcing the regime to accept the result of the 2024 presidential election, which the U.S. and other Western governments say was won by opposition candidate Edmundo Gonzalez, but ignored by Maduro, who stayed in power. Pedro Murillo Borelli, an outspoken opposition member, praised the U.S. military operation that seized Maduro but called the plan for running Venezuela from Washington via regime members bizarre and unacceptable. Panama's president, José Raúl Moreno, who has strongly opposed Maduro, urged Trump to ensure a democratic transition in Venezuela and criticized Trump's backing of Rodriguez, who he called one of the people most committed to Maduro's nefarious dictatorship. With what moral authority can she come to lead a transition to democracy, Moreno said. Maria Corina Machado, the Nobel Prize winner who is widely seen as the country's leading opposition leader, has remained quiet. Other opposition figures say she likely feels she doesn't have much choice but to put her faith in Rubio and Trump and hope a transition eventually comes. We all know democracy won't happen from one day to the next, but this creates a huge opportunity and we want to help push this to a successful conclusion, which is elections, says Freddy Guevara, a former lawmaker who was a political prisoner for more than 3 years and now teaches at the Harvard Kennedy School. Guevara said he trusts the Trump administration will do the right thing and pressure the regime to start the process of negotiations that will eventually lead to a transition. The key, he said, is whether Rodriguez, Cabello, and Padrino realize things have changed and no longer feel untouchable. Maduro felt invincible. And look, where that got him. If these guys feel invincible, it will end badly for them too, he said. World. Israel flexes new diplomatic muscle in recognition of Somaliland. 2 years of war have honed Israeli independence on the world stage, by Benoit Fasson and Dov Lieber. By extending diplomatic recognition to the breakaway statelet of Somaliland, Israel has cut a deal aimed at sharing intelligence and securing the strategic waterways of the Red Sea, making the country a player in the Horn of Africa, where Arab countries are jostling for influence. Now, Israel has a partner directly across the Gulf of Aden from territory in Yemen, held by the Houthis, the militant group that has waged an armed campaign against Israel and ships passing through the Red Sea during the war in Gaza. The attacks snarled global shipping and turned the waterway into a smuggling hub. Somaliland, a semi-desert territory inside internationally recognized Somali borders, lies just south of the vital Bab al-Manab Strait that connects the Red Sea to the Indian Ocean. No one can ignore the strategic location of Somaliland, said Danny Dannon, Israel's ambassador to the United Nations, in an interview. The straits are a strategic point. The move, which drew widespread global condemnation, fits a wider Israeli objective to establish itself on the diplomatic stage as a significant power honed by 2 years at war. Israel is less constrained by what others will say, said Ofer Guterman, a senior researcher at the Tel Aviv-based Institute for National Security Studies. It is moving beyond military might to assert its power in the diplomatic field as well, Guterman added. Israel has emerged from years-long conflict in Gaza, Lebanon, and Iran emboldened as the dominant military power in the Middle East and less interested in compromise when it believes its security interests are at stake. Its recognition of Somaliland, a rare instance in which it has signed such an agreement with a Muslim-majority entity without public U.S. assistance, cements its newfound confidence in the international arena. Somaliland has an underused port and a long runway at Berbera, and has shown a willingness to offer use of the facilities to countries in exchange for closer ties, though officials there say that there were no plans to host an Israeli military base. Still, the moves make Israel an important new variable in an area where a number of Arab countries are competing to hold sway. Somaliland, which declared independence from Somalia during a civil war in 1991, is a self-declared nation of 6.2 million people, which, if it were a nation-state, would be one of the poorest in the world. Its territory is smaller than Missouri. Israel and the U.S. struck back at the Houthi attacks, which have abated since the ceasefire in Gaza, but didn't manage to degrade the militants' command structure in the way Israel took out the leadership of militant groups in Gaza and Lebanon over the past 2 years. Houthi leader Abdul Malik al-Houthi called the recognition a hostile and illegitimate act targeting Somalia, Yemen, and the Red Sea, and warned that any Israeli presence in Somaliland would be considered a military target. Somaliland has, in recent years, been monitoring a Houthi buildup of arms trade and training to a Somali al-Qaeda affiliate called al-Shabaab. The self-declared nation relies on tribal resources to gather information on the militants, but lacks access to more high-tech reconnaissance and interception of the type that Israel could provide. Weapon seizures in Somalia last year revealed that the Houthis were transferring arms to al-Shabaab and training the group to use sophisticated explosives and drones, a Yemen-focused United Nations report said in October. Western security officials fear the Yemeni faction could start staging attacks out of East Africa, effectively cornering shipping from both coastlines. Somalia, which, though not populated by ethnic Arabs, is a member of the Arab League and one of the only of a few sub-Saharan African nations not to recognize Israel, sees the Israeli move as an unacceptable foreign interference. Nations in the Middle East and Africa have largely operated under the understanding that to keep the peace, they won't redraw borders set since independence. It is Israel unilaterally advancing its own interests at the expense of others, said Cameron Hudson, a former Africa director at the U.S. National Security Council, who warned that such a projection of power into the highly contested Horn of Africa could further destabilize the region. Israeli officials have argued that their recognition of Somaliland is grounded in the fact that it has an effective democratic electoral system, with its own military and government acting independently from Somalia for decades. Tammy Bruce, deputy representative of the U.S. to the UN, argued before the Security Council that Israel had a right to conduct its own diplomacy and described Israel's critics as hypocritical, since many of them unilaterally recognized Palestinian statehood earlier in 2025, despite Israeli opposition. Middle Eastern countries have long meddled in Africa, jostling for influence in the most strategic parts of the continent. Turkey, for example, provides military support to the central government in Somalia, which is at loggerheads with Somaliland and another of the country's independent-minded entities, Puntland. The United Arab Emirates and Egypt back opposite sides in Sudan's two-year civil war. Cairo sees Israel's recognition of Somaliland as a direct threat to its conflict over water with Ethiopia, says Egyptian officials. Egypt has been strengthening its alliance with Ethiopia's neighbors to quarter Addis Ababa and prepare for possible future confrontations. Last year, Egypt started positioning troops in Somalia, as well as providing the African country with weapons and counterterrorism advisors. In return for security cooperation, Somaliland hopes the recognition will inspire others to follow suit. The UN doesn't recognize Somaliland's independence. Before Israel's move, only Taiwan, which seeks international support for its autonomy from China, had diplomatic relations with Somaliland, but stopped short of full recognition. A Somaliland attempt in 2014 to gain diplomatic ties with neighboring Ethiopia in exchange for a naval base failed when it faced a backlash from Somalia. Israeli officials, however, appear unmoved by the international condemnation. Spoiler alert, no one will determine for Israel whom it may conduct diplomatic relations with, wrote Israeli Foreign Minister Gideon Sa'ar in an X post. Lifestyle. South Korea's president identifies a new enemy, baldness. Leader likens hair loss to a matter of survival and is pushing for government support. The debate has parted the country right down the middle. By Timothy W. Martin and Soo-young Ri. At a televised policy meeting last month, South Korean President Lee Jae-myung launched into a seemingly banal discussion about health care. He noted people typically spend more on medical expenses as they age. Then came a hair-raising turn. Hair loss is a disease, is it not? The 61-year-old leader asked. Lee, who has a voluminous head of hair, asked the country's health minister whether the state-run health care plan should fit the bill for hair loss treatment. He wants the finances crunched. Total baldness is generally seen as an aesthetic problem covered by out of pocket. Lee retorted that young people with thinning hair view their plight as a matter of survival. While the world is focused on inflation, war, and immigration, South Korea's president is bringing attention to an under-recognized enemy, hair loss. South Korea is globally renowned for its beauty, from heartthrobs, idols, to picturesque actresses, to elaborate skincare regimes, and world-class plastic surgeons. But the looks obsession isn't merely a ruse for exports. Lookism, the advantage afforded to the physically attractive, is a widely accepted concept. Your appearance is also a credential, is a common expression. Nearly all jobs, even for part-time baristas, require a photo with the application. The debate over the left-leaning Lee's proposal to cover hair loss treatments has parted the country right down the middle. Kim Sung-yeon, a 33-year-old medical laboratory scientist, is wholeheartedly behind any government support. He didn't have much hair anxiety until a few years ago when friends pointed out his hair is thinning. He used shampoos promising to reverse hair loss. He applied topical foams. They didn't work. Kim turned to his younger brother, who recommended a hair loss clinic that had helped him. He's waiting to see if it works. It would be great if this were covered, since the cost is quite high, says Kim. He spends roughly $100 a month, but can't stop. I'm worried my hair would all go away in an instant. Seo Eun-ji, 26, doesn't think her tax dollars should fund a problem that can be solved individually and disproportionately affects men. She's not a disinterested party, either. Seo said she started losing her hair in high school. She ate more black beans, lathered her scalp with French soap, and opted for root perms. She now considers her hair thin, though at a sufficient volume. She also keeps it cut short. It's solvable, said Seo, an editor of legal publications. The Korean Medical Association, the country's largest physicians group, called coverage of hair loss treatment questionable given the health system's stretched finances. South Korea is so dominated by luxurious heads of hair, real or imagined, that the few sparse up there public figures can really stand out. One of the nation's most famous actors, Kim Kwang-kyu, became the face of the problem, became the face of a popular meme called the hair loss beam. His photo sat above text that implored recipients to type, "Let my hair grow within 30 seconds or be jokingly cursed to go bald." More than 3 in 4 South Koreans believe that everyone has concerns about hair loss, according to a recent M-Brain Trend Monitor poll. Roughly half of the poll's respondents, despite showing no symptoms of balding, said they were interested in remedies. South Korea, one of the world's least racially diverse countries, has a more rigid definition of beauty than multi-ethnic societies like the U.S., says S. Haejing Lee, a professor at University of Hawaii at Manoa, who has researched South Korea's beauty obsession. "In so many ways, your looks and beauties are a metric for what socioeconomic class you are," Professor Lee says. Professor Lee, who won a snap election in June, made the pledge to cover hair loss treatment when he unsuccessfully ran for president in 2022, but he dropped it when he ran again. At the recent policy meeting, Lee resurrected the idea as a way to appeal to the country's youth, which has grown more dissatisfied with him. "I want you to review this so that young people can feel, I pay my premiums too, I'm getting some benefits," Lee said. The health ministry is reviewing the hair loss treatment's appropriateness for coverage. Implementation can't come soon enough for Lee Ki-yeon, a 26-year-old medical resident. She once had such a lush mane that her hairdressers complained about it. Now it's thinning, which she attributes to work-related stress. She's begun to take topical treatment. She worries having less voluminous hair could limit her job prospects at medical clinics specializing in cosmetic care or dermatology. But for now, she's terrified of what her patients might think when she's providing treatment. "I'm constantly conscious that somebody might be looking at the back of my head," Lee said. Jimin Park, a 27-year-old designer, said he'd rather the government take the funds potentially spent on treatments and redirect them toward finding a cure. His head, for now, is full of hair. But neither of his grandfathers had much. His father has a receding hairline. "Everyone thinks about it," Park says. "The only people who don't worry are those whose parents on both sides have very thick hair." Han Sin-won can hardly remember going bald. The 87-year-old retiree lost most of his hair decades ago. He is perplexed by a potential state intervention, but he empathizes with young people looking to keep up their hair longer. "Once it's all gone," Han said, "there's nothing you can do." Careers. Elite colleges are back at the top of the list for company recruiters. As white-collar hiring slows down and corporate DEI goals vanish, where you went to college matters again. By Lindsay Ellis. The talent is everywhere mantra adopted by U.S. employers when the job market was white hot is giving way to a more traditional entry-level recruiting strategy. Hire from a few select universities. Instead of one or two passes through 45 to 50 schools each year, GE Appliances now attends 4 or 5 events each semester at a slimmer shortlist of 15 select universities that includes Purdue and Auburn. Bill, a financial technology firm, is focused on recruiting heavily from colleges near its corporate offices in San Jose, California, and Draper, Utah. And McKinsey, the white shoe consulting firm that expanded its recruitment efforts well beyond the Ivy League in the wake of George Floyd's murder, recently removed inclusive language from its career page that said, "We hire people, not degrees." A 2025 survey of more than 150 companies found that 26% were exclusively recruiting from a short list of schools, up from 17% that were doing so in 2022, according to Verus Insights, which conducted the research. Nearly all the other firms surveyed said they would use a mix of focusing on target schools, while also accepting online applications from a longer list of colleges. In practice, that means job applicants who attend prestigious universities or schools located close to company headquarters are given priority, said Chelsea Shane, Verisys Vice President of Research Strategy. Everyone's not starting from the same place if some people have access to on-campus engagement and some don't, she said. Even more stark was the change to diversity goals, which led to wider recruiting efforts at many companies. Diversity was a priority for school recruiting selection for 31% of employers surveyed in 2025, down from nearly 60% of those polled in 2022. The hiring trend for new graduates resembles recruiting practices before the pandemic and the tight labor market of 2018 and 2019, researchers who have focused on entry-level hiring say. Most now recruit only up to 30 American colleges out of about 4,000, starting with top-ranked schools and then looking at local universities, said William Chichester III, who spent years directing entry-level recruiting at companies including Target and Peloton. If you fall outside of those two categories, God help you, he added. Outside of divine intervention, he suggests referrals, LinkedIn, and networking. College students and their parents are trying to assess the future of entry-level work in a white-collar employment landscape marked by slow hiring, layoffs, and AI displacement of knowledge workers. The return to old-school recruiting strategies is another reason many graduates are seeing fewer job offers. Entry-level recruiters cite several reasons for the pullback. Diversity-driven recruiting has fallen out of favor. So too have virtual events because students and employers have said they preferred in-person interactions. But visiting a range of campuses is expensive. Companies are flooded with ChatGPT-generated resumes that look identical, so a job candidate's college can be a distinguishing factor, and focusing on key schools helps hiring managers cull thousands of applicants for one position. As in-person work becomes a mandate for many offices, recruiters say companies also like to target locals, since some Gen Z grads won't move far from where they grew up and fewer employers are willing to pay relocation packages. When Dora Martin, 22 years old, started studying business at the University of Louisville in 2021, businesses recruited students with an appealing message, she recalled. We'll take anyone and everyone and give them experience. By her senior year, local companies attended campus career fairs, but she was unsuccessful when applying to corporate jobs outside of the region. It was very defeating, said Martin, who has been teaching English in Madrid since her May 2025 graduation and is nervous about rebooting her corporate job search. Since the height of the pandemic, which was also the zenith of virtual job recruiting, a lot of those employers who were new to us didn't stick around, said Bill Fletcher, head of the Career Center at the University of Louisville. In contrast, local companies, including Yum Brands, which owns KFC and Taco Bell, said it participates in 2 to 4 events annually at the university. And every year, GE Appliances hires between 30 and 50 interns from the college, which is considered a core school, said Jessica Nguyen, who manages university relations for the company. Several years ago, GE Appliances tech, sales, and supply chain divisions would pick their own schools when recruiting. Now they all draw from the same 15 campuses, selected for their proximity to headquarters, majors offered, and academic ranking, Nguyen said. School alumni who work at GE Appliances help with recruiting and students can get a next-day interview in person. Molly Gregware, a former director of early careers recruiting and programs at Bill, said the company pivoted to hire from a few schools near its offices by 2024 to trim costs. The company declined to comment. McKinsey is recommitting to a high-touch process by hosting in-person events and the chance to meet alumni who work at the consulting firm to students at a short list of about 20 core schools, said Blair Cecil, a partner who oversees recruiting. Some of those schools are Vanderbilt and Notre Dame, she said. Key assessments include gauging an applicant's curiosity and ability to read a room. which are increasingly important skills as AI takes over other parts of consulting jobs, such as making slide decks. McKinsey doesn't want large numbers of students from other schools to apply because most of them would be rejected. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Which wouldn't benefit them or the firm, Cecil said. Instead, recruiters will use AI to find students on non-core campuses who have similar profiles to McKinsey's star hires, she said. That could mean the same major or similar extracurricular activities, for example. Firm data shows that hires from non-core campuses often perform better than those from core schools, she added. Last year, McKinsey ultimately hired from about 80 schools. We know that this distinctive talent is not only centered at a handful of, I'll call them, elite sources, Cecil said. A spokeswoman said McKinsey still wants people with remarkable capabilities, regardless of their school. Johnson C. Smith University in Charlotte, North Carolina, enrolls about 1,300 students, many of whom are the first in their family to go to college and eligible for financial aid. The university's location in a finance hub helps students meet company representatives from Wells Fargo and Bank of America, said Christian Varnando, an assistant director at the campus's Career Services Center. While some employers outside the region still advertise jobs with his students, Varnando said those recruiters don't attend in-person events. There are certainly companies where it's almost like playing the lottery, he said. He advises students to start strategizing about their job search even before enrolling freshman year, and to look for opportunities where others won't, for instance, by researching the top 100 companies in an industry instead of just a few. Policy. ICE is using facial recognition technology to quickly arrest people. Widespread use has raised alarms among privacy advocates and some former officials. Michelle Hackman, Adrian Campo Flores, and Hannah Critchfield. Until recently, arresting an immigrant suspected of being in the country illegally took time. Immigration agents needed to run the suspect's various forms of ID through different systems, and if the results were inconclusive, book the person into custody for further investigation. But during President Trump's second term, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers have been handed a powerful new tool to speed up arrests: mobile facial recognition technology. Officers can simply point their phones at a suspect's face, snap a picture, and turn up the person's identity, and often their immigration status. This app, called Mobile Fortify, has in the past few months become a routine feature of ICE arrests, according to current and former government officials. Agency officials say the technology has made arrests both faster and more accurate, leading to fewer occasions when officers must detain someone only to learn hours later that they have legal status or even are a U.S. citizen. With an unprecedented $75 billion infusion from Congress this summer, on top of its normal budget, ICE has become the most well-funded law enforcement agency in the federal government. It has been using that money in part to experiment with new technologies to supercharge Trump's promised mass deportation. In recent months, the agency has greenlighted a contract for a tool that can scan subjects' irises and recruited several artificial intelligence-fueled companies to locate immigrants. President Trump's core promise to the American people was to remove criminal and public safety threats in large numbers, and these technologies provide federal law enforcement tools to make that challenge more manageable, said Chad Wolf, chairman of Homeland Security and Immigration at the America First Policy Institute and a former acting Homeland Security secretary during Trump's first term. ICE's parent agency, the Department of Homeland Security, is investing more money than ever in facial recognition technology to power programs, including touchless scans at airport security checkpoints and an entry-exit program to track everyone leaving the country on flights, alarming civil rights advocates. The government's spending on certain companies known to provide surveillance technologies has jumped significantly in the past decade, with over $30 million in contracts awarded this year, according to a Wall Street Journal analysis of federal contracting data. Mobile Fortify is a lawful law enforcement tool developed under the Trump administration to support accurate identity and immigration status verification during enforcement operations, a DHS spokeswoman said in a statement. In one instance witnessed by a Journal reporter in July, ICE officers in Lake Worth, Florida, snapped pictures of two Guatemalan men whom a state trooper had just stopped. The app, along with databases the officers could access through a laptop, showed that one of the men had been encountered before by the Border Patrol and had given a notice to appear in the court, one of them said. We have a new app, it's facial recognition, the officer said during another stop that day. If they've ever been arrested before and we have their photo in one of our databases, we'll get a hit. The app has access to several government criminal databases. The data includes previous encounters with immigration officials, such as if an immigrant was arrested at a southern border or entered at a legal entry point, officials said. It also taps into publicly available sources, including social media posts, officials familiar with the matter said. That information informs deeper queries the app can conduct, which can provide more information on people, such as other names they might use, their previous locations, and social connections, the people said. The DHS spokeswoman said the application doesn't access open source material, scrape social media, or rely on publicly available data. Its use is governed by established legal authorities and formal privacy oversight, which set strict limits on data access, use, and retention. ICE guidance states officers don't need permission to take a photo, though the technology works best when a picture is taken within about 4 feet, according to a government official. The photos are then stored in a government database. It has been used in the field more than 100,000 times, the official said. The technology has been programmed to return only confirmed identity matches from facial scans, excluding results that are close but not definitive. ICE is working on offering a scaled-down version of the technology to local police departments that work alongside federal immigration officials. The app's existence was earlier reported by 404 Media, a digital publication focused on technology and privacy. Similar technology has hit snags in the past. Under the Biden administration, migrants wanting to enter the country legally could make an appointment at a legal border crossing through an app called CBP One, which required them to snap a photo of themselves as part of the process. Several lawyers and immigration advocates said the technology struggled to recognize faces with darker complexion. Haitian migrants in particular found it difficult to make appointments. After months of complaints, the Biden administration improved the facial recognition algorithm so darker skin tones would register more accurately. Now Mobile Fortify's widespread use by ICE has raised concerns among privacy advocates and some former officials who argue the app is devouring huge amounts of personal information without adequate oversight. It can be used to point at people in the street, people in cars, and scan their facial prints without their consent, said Kate Voigt, a senior policy counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union. The DHS spokeswoman said the app is lawfully used nationwide in accordance with all applicable legal authorities. Typically, when the government introduces a new technology involving facial recognition or other personal information, they must file what's called a privacy impact assessment, but the journal couldn't find any assessments filed specifically for the new app. Mobile Fortify was first created by ICE's sister agency, U.S. Customs and Border Protection, under the Biden administration. The app was built borrowing from technology that the government is using to build an entry-exit system, tracking people who arrive and leave the U.S. on commercial flights, according to current and former government officials. At first, the tech was handed only to Border Patrol agents, who most often work within 100 miles of the southern border. In that zone, agents can conduct stops and searches without the same constitutional protections that apply in the interior of the country. At the time, lawyers at DHS objected to ICE using the facial recognition tool, citing privacy concerns, some of the current and former government officials said. They warned that a negative court decision could jeopardize the government's ability to use facial recognition at the border, including at legal entry points, those officials said. The decision was reversed when Trump took office. Trump reiterates that the U.S. is in charge of Venezuela. Delcy Rodriguez strikes softer tone. Speaking with reporters on Air Force One, the president signaled his enthusiasm for more actions. President Trump threatened Colombia over its role in drug flows, said Cuba is ready to fall, and repeated his position that the U.S. needs to control Greenland for its own national security. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro is slated to appear in Manhattan federal court on Monday. The ousted Venezuelan leader brought to New York with his wife after their capture by American forces in a dramatic military operation on Saturday faces charges related to cocaine trafficking. He is being held in a Brooklyn jail. Trump reiterated that the U.S. would be calling the shots in Venezuela following earlier remarks that indicated the U.S. would run Venezuela until there can be a proper transition. Secretary of State Marco Rubio on Sunday said the U.S. would be running policy after Maduro's removal. The oil-rich nation's de facto leader is leftist Delcy Rodriguez, who served as Maduro's vice president. After demanding Maduro's release, Rodriguez struck a softer tone toward the U.S. on Sunday night. The U.S. plan for Venezuela includes taking a tremendous amount of wealth out of the ground and sharing it in part with Venezuelans, Trump said. He added the U.S. oil companies would spend billions of dollars in Venezuela to fix its oil infrastructure. Chevron and others in the U.S. oil and gas industry didn't receive advance notice of the U.S. incursion or the Trump administration's broader Venezuela strategy, according to people familiar with the matter. The Justice Department and federal law enforcement agencies defended their role in the seizure of Maduro, saying in a joint statement that the U.S. had pursued every lawful opportunity to resolve this matter peacefully. The United Nations Security Council will hold an emergency meeting Monday morning, saying that they were deeply alarmed by the U.S. incursion. Asian markets surge, shrugging off Venezuelan conflict by Peter Landers. The strife in Venezuela did little to cloud a happy new year in Asian markets, with stocks up across the board on optimism about artificial intelligence gains in 2026. Benchmark indices in Japan and South Korea both rose by about 3%, powered by technology shares such as SoftBank Group and Samsung Electronics, while indices in China and Southeast Asia were broadly higher. Defense shares also gained, with top Japanese military contractor Mitsubishi Heavy Industries closing up 8.4%. Oil prices fell slightly. Analysts said the ouster of President Nicolas Maduro was unlikely to limit short-term output of oil in Venezuela and might raise supplies over the longer term if the country revamps an oil industry hobbled by decades of mismanagement and underinvestment. National security. A new Trump game plan takes shape. Strike and coerce. Administration's reliance on surprise use of force in Venezuela and other countries highlights new era of gunboat diplomacy by Michael R. Gordon and David S. Klepp. The U.S. raid that snatched Venezuela's president capped a month of aggressive military action by President Trump that also included targeting alleged extremists in northern Nigeria, attacking Islamic State militants in Syria, and threatening to restrike Iran. The flurry of military moves underscored Trump's reliance on the surprise use of force during his second term, an emerging doctrine to strike and then coerce that is likely to be sorely tested as the White House seeks to press Venezuela and other countries he targets to comply with his demands. In returning to a form of gunboat diplomacy in Venezuela, Trump has largely spurned the usual veneer of armed interventions, acting without an Oval Office speech justifying the attack, congressional authorization, a promise of elections in a foreign land, or even a detailed plan for its future. The operation in Caracas, which involved inserting U.S. Army Delta Force commandos and use of more than 150 warplanes, shared some of the features of Trump's other operations this year, such as the B-2 bomber attack on Iran's nuclear sites and its nearly two-month-long operation against the Houthis in Yemen. It disrupted the status quo but stopped short of a major commitment of ground forces that might give the White House more influence over Venezuela's future while risking deeper involvement and more American lives. Trump has boasted that it was a model for future military action, telling Fox News on Saturday it was an incredible thing and insisting we can do it again, too. Nobody can stop us. Yet it is also a strategy that risks overstretching the Pentagon if Trump continues the intense pace of armed interventions abroad or gets bogged down in open-ended conflicts if his limited military moves don't achieve his goals. Despite Trump's reputation as an isolationist, his record to date is taking an overtaxed military and finding new ways to spread it even thinner, said Stephen Wertheim of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. The other major risk is it could leave the White House increasingly isolated internationally by alienating allies unwilling to support unilateral action. Trump has been careful to avoid many of the pitfalls of past U.S. military interventions by limiting operations, as he did with a one-day attack on Iran's nuclear facilities in June. He has abruptly halted military operations and declared victory, as he did when he ceased strikes in Houthi militants in Yemen last year, after they agreed to stop attacks on U.S. ships in the Red Sea. The Houthis continued their missiles and drone attacks on Israel. In Venezuela, however, the administration has far-reaching goals and a strategy for achieving them that appears in flux. Secretary of State Marco Rubio signaled Sunday that the Trump administration was counting on a naval blockade of oil exports to pressure the country's authorities to yield to U.S. demands that Venezuela allow Western companies to access oil fields that were nationalized years ago and halt cooperation with India, with Iran, Cuba, China, and Russia. A second wave of attacks that Trump warned Saturday might be ordered if Venezuela's remaining leaders don't bend to U.S. demands is in abeyance for now, backing away from talk that the U.S. would run the country. American officials aren't urging early elections or a major role for Maria Corina Machado, the Nobel Prize-winning opposition leader. Trump officials say they are carrying out their new national security strategy, which calls for American preeminence in the Western Hemisphere. We want to surround ourselves with good neighbors. We want to surround ourselves with stability. We want to surround ourselves with energy, Trump said Saturday. He has threatened Venezuela's new de facto leader, Delcy Rodriguez, with similar treatment as Nicolas Maduro if she defies U.S. demands. Trump's argument has drawn sharp criticism from Democrats. For nearly 70 years, we've tried to move away from the idea that America was going to be a colonial power in the Americas, Senator Mark Warner, Democrat Virginia, the top Democrat on the Intelligence Committee, said. That all went out the window. The operation has also alarmed some conservative critics who recall Trump's denunciations of using force to carry out regime change and nation building on the campaign trail, and his vow in his 2025 inauguration speech to avoid unnecessary wars. Whether the impact has a longer-term effect on the U.S. global military posture will likely depend on whether the American military maintains a major offshore presence near Venezuela for many months to come or employs ground forces as the Trump administration strives to shape the political transition in the country. Ousting Maduro can help the U.S. by removing a Chinese and Russian foothold in the Western Hemisphere, said Matt Croning of the Atlanta Council, who was a former national security advisor on Rubio's 2016 presidential campaign. The Pentagon is capable of carrying out operations across multiple theaters as long as it doesn't get bogged down in a military quagmire inside Venezuela. In Trump's first term, he was more restrained about using military force. He accused Maduro of leading a drug smuggling organization, but pursued a much different policy. Elliot Abrams, who served as the U.S. Special Representative for Venezuela during Trump's first term, said that American policy at the time was to encourage the establishment of a transitional government, which would call for new elections and a transition to democracy. But it was never envisioned that Washington would move militarily to apprehend Maduro, take control of the country, or come to an arrangement that would defer talk of restoring democracy while leaving much of Maduro's regime in place, Abrams said. We have to make a distinction here between this crazy notion that we are going to run the country and plans for helping with the transition, Abrams said in an interview Sunday. We have helped with democratic transitions all over, particularly in South America. Trump launched air and missile strikes in 2017 and 2018 against Syria, after then-President Bashar al-Assad was accused of using chemical weapons, but he didn't intervene in the civil war. He later called off a plan to strike Iran after it shot down a U.S. drone, saying he did so because he was concerned it would result in too many casualties. In 2020, he ordered a drone strike that killed Iranian General Qasem Soleimani, head of the Quds Force, claiming it was to stop imminent attacks on U.S. personnel. When Iran responded by firing ballistic missiles at U.S. bases in Iraq that caused no deaths, Trump took no further action. Artificial intelligence, the physicist who has appealed to the Pope and Elon Musk on AI safety. Max Tegmark wants to halt development of artificial superintelligence and has Steve Bannon, Meghan Markle, and Will.i.am as supporters. By Keech Hagney and Sam Schechner, Max Tegmark, the MIT physics professor who has become an AI safety campaigner, emerged from days of meetings in a Vatican conference room in September with a stack of paper slips about the size of business cards. He had been invited by the Vatican to a conclave-style meeting of academics, entrepreneurs, and human rights advocates to draft a policy appeal on AI safety to present to Pope Leo. Tegmark had been trying to get the group to oppose uncontrollable superintelligence in the text. Now it was time for a Hail Mary. He handed fellow attendee Marco Trombetti, chief executive of the AI translation company Translated, one of the papers printed with a call to stall the development of AI with human-like intelligence until it could be done safely. Walking between Renaissance-era buildings, Tegmark said in a low voice, "Marco, would you sign a statement like this?" Trombetti hesitated at first. For more than a decade, Tegmark's organization, the Future of Life Institute, had been trying to raise the alarm that advanced AI could be catastrophic to humanity. Shortly after the launch of OpenAI's ChatGPT, the Future of Life Institute made a famous call for a pause in the most advanced AI development. Now he was asking for something even more audacious, a potential halt in the race to build superintelligence that was powering the stock market. Trombetti ultimately signed along with more than 130,000 other people, including AI luminary Jeffrey Hinton, MAGA diehard Steve Bannon, former government official Susan Rice, and celebrities Will.i.am, Prince Harry, and Meghan Markle. Tegmark's language even found its way into the appeal to the Pope. At 58, with his trademark motorcycle jacket, mop of brown hair, and black t-shirt decrying AGI, AI with human-like intelligence, Tegmark presents a bit like a nerdy Ramone. "This is by far the most successful thing we've ever done," he said during a recent interview near his home in the Boston suburbs, referring to the number of signatures the statement nabbed compared with the organization's past open letters. The politics of AI are changing. Concerns about risks that were once confined to debates among geeks have gone mainstream and increasingly bipartisan, fueled by fears about what AI is going to do to the job market. About half of Americans say they are more concerned than excited about AI, according to a recent Pew Research Center group, up from 37% in 2021, with concerns on both sides of the aisle. One marker of this trend, Tegmark's recent appearance on Bannon's War Room podcast, where the host said his message resonates with the far-right audience worried about jobs, despite the Trump administration's accelerationist approach to AI. Our show is the biggest supporter of President Trump, but on this one, people want to slow down, number one, and they want guardrails, Bannon said in an interview. On the other side of the aisle, Virginia Democrat Representative Don Baer, co-chair of the Congressional AI Caucus, agrees with Tegmark. The people I represent are way more concerned about AI than excited about, said Baer. Critics of the push for regulations, such as Trump AI czar David Sachs, argue that the U.S. cannot afford to lose the AI race to China. Buttonholing Musk. Born in Sweden to a Swedish psychologist mother and an American mathematician father, Tegmark studied economics before shifting to physics, earning his PhD in the subject from the University of California at Berkeley. He joined MIT's physics department in 2004. A physics conference first brought him into the orbit of Jan Tallinn, the Skype co-founder who has become one of the biggest philanthropists funding AI safety efforts. Tegmark pitched Tallinn on his vision for an organization that would help with this fight, and he agreed to fund it with an initial $100,000. And that's all we have time for today. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Cicely Tiernan, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.